Kind of a day to be able to have everybody here that's graduating and to be able to acknowledge them. We have a special speaker in town. Kimberly's grandfather came in all the way from Minnesota, and so it's an appropriate time to have him speak to our young people. I asked him if he would speak to them as they start on a new page of life, start on a new venture, new chapter in their lives. Speaking from the other end of life, can I say it that way without... He's 70 years old now this year. But one of the things that I'm thankful for and honored in my father-in-law is the fact that all of his adult life has been in ministry, and he continues faithful in ministry. So it's worth hearing from our grads, listening with ears, remembering and looking for what it looks like to having gone the distance and having done all to stand. And so I've asked him to share from his testimony, from his life, a passage that God's used, one of those anchor texts that he goes back to over the course of life, not having learned it all when he got his diploma, but having learned it along the way as God shepherds him to be a shepherd. And so that's the heartbeat behind what we've asked him to share this morning. And so, Pastor Rogers, you go ahead and come. Share with us what God's been doing in your life over a long haul.
Well, good morning. We're looking at Matthew chapter 20. We are from Minnesota, and we're from Wilmer, Minnesota, which is the turkey capital of the world, which is 1 million turkeys come our process each week in Wilmer. I'm pastor of the Cornerstone Baptist Church there, and Colleen is our oldest daughter, and of nine, and the youngest one passed away in 1996. So we have our grandchildren here, and there's five of them, but there's going to be 33 in just a little bit, about another couple weeks. We're looking forward to that one. Let's read Matthew 20, I'm reading from the King James and not from ESV, but it'll be similar, of course. Matthew 20, 20, then came to him the mother of Zebedee's children, which is James and John, as we find elsewhere in Scripture, with their sons worshiping him and desiring a certain thing of him. And he said unto her, what wilt thou? She said to him, grant that these my two sons may sit, the one on the right hand and the other on the left in the kingdom. But Jesus answered and said, ye know not what ye ask. Are ye able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of and to be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? They said to him, we are able. And he said to them, ye shall drink indeed of my cup and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father. And when the 10 heard it, they were moved with indignation against the two brethren. But Jesus called them unto him and said, ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto you, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many, which he did with two blind men. And he showed the example to them. Every time a mass shooting or mass shooting occurs, the question always comes up among the authorities, why did they do it? So the authorities investigate their texts on their phone, their posts, and statements to others as they interview them. And a lot of times they find that they've been radicalized. They have been provoked or persuaded to kill for the cause. But it's interesting that they have found that there's besides this cause, that there is something else at the surface that's quite unique in our thinking anyway. They kill for a claim. This came news to us as we invited someone from Illinois up to Minnesota to help us with security against shootings and to help us to know what to do. And in his presentation, they have examined these things and said that most of these that are killing that are not radicalized or for a cause are because they're seeking a claim. So they'll be heard, their name will be heard in newscasts and magazines and different media publications. Therefore, to prevent this, 140 scholars have got together, and professors and law enforcement officials, and they publicized a letter encouraging the media not to name their name, so that there'll be no copycats because they're trying to get a name. So some writers and broadcasters now refuse to give the name. One of them that's famous, I guess, would be Megyn Kelly. Cal Thomas also has refused to put those names in print. And even our own president, in his half-hour broadcast against domestic violence, purposely left out names of those who are involved in these things. The desire for a claim is not new. And turn to Isaiah chapter 14, a passage that seemingly is about Satan, Isaiah 14. Apparently this desire for a claim really comes from Satan, because he desired it too. He desired position and thus the recognition from it. And so verse 12 says, "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thy heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit upon the mount of the congregation on the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High." Now, I'm sure he knew he couldn't be God. I mean, he'd been enough time with God, at least a week or two, to know that God is all-powerful, God is everything. But at least he could rule in his realm. He could be independently rebellious of God, and he could be like the Most High. He could be exalted, and he could rule his own. Satan ever since has fostered this independent rebellion against God to exalt yourself and to live for self, really. And perhaps that's what Adam and Eve, let's go to Genesis 3:5. I can never see why they would go after that tree of the knowledge of good and evil when they had God, walk in the cool of the garden with God, and to have all the things of the Garden of Eden, which is so wonderful, and the animals that were friendly at that time, and every plant they could eat. I could never see it. But you read this, and it must have been alluring to have this temptation in front of them, greatly alluring. For Satan tempted them, "For God doth know," in verse 5, "that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be open, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil," but as gods. It's kind of unusual, because there's no one to really to boast to, but they at least would have this exaltation that they were as gods. Cain, their son, went out from the presence of the Lord and established a whole civilization against the Lord. Independent rebellion against the Lord. And they're last in the line, is Lamech. And we read in Genesis chapter 4, that verse in verse 23, "And Lamech said unto his wives Ada and Zillah, Hear my voice, ye wives of Lamech. Hearken unto my speech, for I have slain a man to my wounding and a young man to my hurt." And of course, Cain, going back, he had this protection from the Lord. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and 70-fold. More or less boasting in the fact in his notoriety that was even above his ancestor Cain. And so this desire for notoriety is there. The whole pre-flood civilization was like that. And so we turn to Genesis 6 and verse 4. Says, "There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, that they bare children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown." Mighty men in the eyes of the world, but not in the eyes of God. And then it became, and after the post-flood generation, in Genesis chapter 11, the whole society had that desire to make a name through that tower. Genesis chapter 11 and verse 4, "And they said, Go to, let us build us a city and tower, whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, that lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." We can so easily be caught up in our society as starting young, as young people. I can remember some of the dreams I had of greatness, of athletic ability. And my sister and I used to talk about the Olympics and how we would excel in the Olympics. And I kind of laugh at that now because there's no way I was even close to being something of an Olympic athlete. But it was a dream, and it was a desire for a name in those things. It was a desire among his disciples. If you turn to Luke chapter 9 and verse 46, Luke 9, 46, they were arguing about who was the greatest among them. 9:46 says this, "Then there arose a reasoning among them, which of them should be greatest," the greatest of the 12 disciples. And yet that's right after Jesus had talked about how he came to minister and to serve. Verse 44, "Let your sayings sink down to ears, for the Son of Man should be delivered in the hands of men." But they understood not his saying, it was hid from them. They perceived it not, and they feared to ask of that saying. Then there arose a reasoning among them, who is the greatest. Two of those disciples, John and James, argued or came secretly to Jesus. In Matthew 20, as we've read this passage, to ensure that their greatness and their exaltation would be forever acknowledged in the kingdom. And they had read the Old Testament. They knew the Old Testament. And the kingdom is all over the place in the Old Testament. And so Matthew 20, they came with their mother, who is related, of course, to Mary. And so there's a relationship of family there. And his mother, their mother, had followed Jesus around and ministered to him, so there was a closeness there too. And so she asked the Lord that her sons could be number one, number two, Jesus be number one, and they'd be number two and number three in the kingdom. They came with a serious request, knowing that, believing that Jesus would be king over the earth. Jesus was gaining in popularity. They had spent 3+ years with Jesus, and he was gaining in popularity. If you look at chapter 19 and verses 1 and 2, and it came to pass that when Jesus had finished these sayings, he departed from Galilee and came into the coasts of Judea beyond Jordan, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. But great multitudes were following him. They'd seen it for 3.5 years or so. The multitudes. They saw the great power of Christ, even over demons, when it came to the demoniac. And there was a legion of demons. And they felt that if he could be more part, that Christ could control demons, that he could destroy the Roman army. You think about demons and you think about angels, the power of angels, one angel just defeating whole armies in the Bible. And these are fallen angels, but there's power. They had power. And he defeated and said to those legion of angels, depart. And they cast out and went into those pigs and down that hillside. The dead were raised. The blind saw. Lepers were healed. And hopefully my ear will heal someday. Even the wind and the sea obeyed him. The apostles were amazed in that boat trip that the wind and sea obeyed him. So any day they felt that Christ would become the messianic king, the king of the whole universe. They're mentioned in the Bible. Her two boys had been handpicked by the Lord. They had been privileged to be part of the three inner circle, the 12 apostles, but three would be privileged to go, in many cases, to private meetings where they'd heal privately, and they were invited to go into. They were at the Transfiguration, but they weren't allowed to talk about it, but I wonder if they didn't, at least to Mom. And they were there with Moses, the lawgiver, and Elijah, the prophet, the great prophet. They were the inside circle of three. They felt this could be it. They were just fishermen before that, and the fishermen who fished at night, and no one saw them. They slept during the day and went out at night. And here was the opportunity of a lifetime to be number two and number three in the kingdom. And she would be the proud mother and could boast of her children. When the other 10 heard of it, they were filled with indignation. And our first thought would be, they're filled with indignation because how could someone be so selfish as to desire this lust for power? No. As we've looked at other passages like we did in Luke 9, they were filled with indignation because they've been outmaneuvered by these two who had gone secretly and asked for these positions of authority. Before you get too harsh on these fellows, think about your own desires for a claim and a name and for exaltation. To be on, as maybe an athlete, to be on Sports Illustrated, to be a great musician that was acknowledged throughout the world, and different types of acclamation, to have your name in Wikipedia, or when you put your name in Google and it comes up as someone of importance. It's not that God doesn't want us to have a name. It's not that God doesn't want us acclaimed. or to be in exalted positions, as you see over in chapter 19. After the rich man had walked away from the Lord, and verse 27 of 19 said, "Then answered Peter and said to him, Behold, we have forsaken all and followed thee. What shall we have therefore? And Jesus said unto them, Verily I say unto you, that ye which have followed me in the regeneration, when the Son of Man shall sit in the throne of his glory, ye also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone that hath forsaken houses, or brethren, or sisters, or fathers, or mother, or wife, or children, or lands, for my name's sake shall receive 100-fold, and shall inherit everlasting life. But many that are first shall be last, and the last shall be first." And so those who think that they have this great name in the world's eyes will be last, and the last who don't or are not honored by the world will be first in the kingdom. So it's not that God doesn't want us to have a name or exaltation, but whose name are we, for whom are we desirous to have a name in front of? Do we want a name in the world, among the world, or a name and fame and acclamation of God? Is a claim in the eyes of the world a greatness in the eyes of God? The second question follows the first. How do I obtain fame or acclaim or greatness in the eyes of God? And so Jesus was going to correct their vision. We often refer to Matthew 20:20 as 20/20 vision. But he's correcting his disciples and giving them 20/20 vision. How do we have acclaim, fame in the eyes of God? What is the road to acclaim? The road to acclaim goes through suffering from the world. It starts with suffering from the world. The cup of the Lord is mentioned here as he's correcting his disciples. He says in verse 22, "But Jesus answered and said, Ye know not what ye ask. Are ye able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of, and to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" Jesus suffered that cup on the cross of Calvary. He suffered for us. It was suffering that led to exaltation. He made himself of no reputation and took upon him the form of a servant, was made in the likeness of men, and being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore, God also highly exalted him and gave him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of things in heaven, things in earth, and things under the earth. So that exaltation came as he ministered, as he suffered. Now, we can't suffer like Christ in dying for sin, because we're sinners, and took a righteous man, perfect man, to suffer for us. But when we tell others about Christ, and when we live the Christ life, we are going to experience the suffering for Jesus. Turn to John 15 and see that in John 15. This is the warning of Christ, that this is the name that he wants us to have, the claim. And so John 15 and verse 18 says, "If the world hates you, ye know that it hated me before it hated you. If ye were of the world would love his own. But because you're not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you." That's the cup of suffering that we have through Christ. Your notoriety in the world will just be the opposite of what they would choose. If we turn to 1 Corinthians 4, I want us to look at that. The Corinthians had a desire for a wisdom of the world, and to be in that area. And Paul kind of makes a little example of himself and contrasts himself. In 1 Corinthians 4:8, now ye are full, now ye are rich, ye have reigned as kings without us, and I would to God ye did reign, that ye also might reign with you. For I think that God has set forth us, the apostles, last, as it were, appointed to death. For we are made a spectacle unto the world, and to angels, and to men. We are fools for Christ's sake. Fools for Christ's sake. There's a second road to fame or exaltation with God. And that road goes through submission. Submission in verse 23. He asks, are ye able to drink of the cup? They say unto him, we are able. I hope I wouldn't answer that way. It's a hard life, but we have the Lord. Verse 23, he saith unto them, ye shall drink indeed of my cup, and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with, but to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father. And so it's not a matter that we can maneuver into, to make demands. When he said, grant that my sons, she was actually asking Christ to give an order that her two sons would be there. But it's a matter of submitting to what God wants us to do in this life. And it's no matter what position it is, whatever it is. It can be some lowly position of whatever it is, but that's highly exalted in God's eyes. It can be as an apostle, but they were just chosen to be apostles. And they were exalted in their faithfulness to the Lord. If we're faithful to do what the Lord wants us to do, whatever it is, could be as a pastor, a small church, which I have, or a large church, but it's more the faithfulness is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. It's more not asking, Lord, give me this position, but Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? And the Lord then gives those positions and rewards. And as we've read that passage in chapter 19 about those who have forsaken, all shall be given, as it said, forsaken houses of brethren and sisters, shall receive 100-fold. Well, it's 10,000 times, I think, if I figure right, what we would have. And but many that are first shall be last, and last first. And then he gives a parable of this master who then hires laborers to go out into the vineyard, and he hires some early, and then some a little later in the day, and some a little bit later in the day, and finally at the last hour, there's only 1 hour left, he hires this last person to come. But then he tells his steward to pay him all the same thing. They all get the same thing, same amount. Now, the one that was first kind of complained, he really complained about it. But in the end, he says in verse 16, reversing what he has said in verse 30 of chapter 19, where the first shall be last, he says the last shall be first. And so the last shall be first and the first last, for many be called but few chosen. We can relate to salvation, but he's really getting after the fact that his disciples they'll be given rewards. No matter, we can just trust the Lord if we humbly submit to what He has given to us to do. He'll take care of us. He'll exalt us, however lowly it is or what position. The last 11th hour guy got the same pay as the first hour person. Finally, the road goes through serving. Serving in verse 25 through 28. Jesus contrasts the world's concept of greatness and acclaim with what it is in the eyes of God. The world's concept is not to be copied, he said. He says, Jesus called them, you know that the prince of the Gentiles exercised dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority. But it shall not be so among you. This is not something to copy. The world's concept is where you dominate people, that you exalt yourself over people, and now you're giving orders to people and telling them what to do. That is also inspired by Satan, as written in Paradise Lost by Milton. Better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven, as he said. But Jesus relates to greatness is to minister and to serve, not living for our glory or applause or our thanks, or thanks from someone else, but honestly trying to help someone for the sake of Christ, for His glory. And so as graduates in high school, I was a principal of a Christian school for probably 6 years, and I've always tried to emphasize to the students there's something about education. You're learning to proclaim Christ wherever you go, to learn your English and your speech to better to communicate God's message. And you learn your math to be a proper stewardship of God's inheritance. You learn history because it's His story that you want to tell, and science because it's God's world. And you keep on learning. We had this conversation earlier this week about how we'll be ever learning about God because He's infinite. And so we are always learning to better communicate and to serve God better. James Irving, who made a successful moonwalk, as he was coming back to Earth, suddenly realized he'd be a superhero. But something greater hit him as he's coming back to Earth. As I was returning to Earth, I realized I was a servant and not a celebrity. I am here as God's servant on planet Earth to share what I've experienced that others might know, the glory of God. Jesus then relates in verse 27, whoso be chief among you, let him be your servant, even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto you, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. Ruth Callahan wrote about Christ and the washing of the disciples' feet. And who was it this morning? One of my granddaughters, I won't point, said, how do you say W-A-S-H? I said, well, in Iowa we say wash. She said, there's no R in wash, but that's how we say it in Iowa, because there's no R in Iowa, so that we have to put it somewhere else. But she didn't quite get that. But so there's no one that washed the disciples' feet as they're coming into this rented room or room given to them. Normally a servant would do that, but none of them humbled themselves to do that. Jesus takes a towel and a basin and he washes the disciples' feet. He shows them what a servant is. He gives them an example and says to them, follow my example in life. And she wrote this poem, you know, Lord, how I serve you with great emotional fervor in the limelight. You know, Lord, how eagerly I speak of you at the woman's club. You know how I effervesce where I promote a fellowship group. You know my genuine enthusiasm at a Bible study. But I wonder how I would react. I wonder if you pointed to a basin of water and asked me to wash the callous feet of a bent and wrinkled old woman day after day, month after month, in a room where nobody sees and nobody knows. No one gives thanks. There's no acclaim. There's no fame. But there is with the Lord. And that's what our life should be about. Serving the Lord, no matter what we get in return on this earth, but it will be in heaven. Let's pray.